So this then was the case against Edward Hudson and Dorothy Holt, heard by two Maryland judges at St. Mary's City, the capital of the colony, on November 6th and 7th, 1651. No jury was impaneled. Why is not clear from the records, although the defendants could have chosen to have a trial by judges alone, or it could have just been the short notice. I mean, this is a sparsely populated area. It might have been impossible in just 3 or 4 days to accumulate 12 guys who could come and be the jury. So I don't know. There is no jury. There's just judges. Edward Hudson and Dorothy Holt were formally charged with, this is the charge against them, diverse, lewd, incontinent, and scandalous actions and practices. Now, such vague terms were commonly used in 17th century sexual offense trials, for the words encompass both adultery and fornication. Adultery was sex with someone, not one's spouse, and so it could only be committed by a married person, whereas fornication was a crime committed solely by the unmarried. Both offenses were involved in this case because Dorothy was married while Edward was single. So Dorothy was charged with adultery, Edward was charged with fornication, but they're both charged with diverse, lewd, incontinent, and scandalous actions and practices. The relevant Maryland statute had been adopted 18 months earlier. It read, quote, "Every person or persons that shall be found or proved by confession of either party to have committed adultery or fornication, such offender or offenders shall be censured or punished as the governor and council or other chief judge and commissioners present in court shall adjudge and think fit, not extending to life or member." End quote. So in other words, the judges were given complete discretion to determine the penalties for such crimes short of hanging or dismemberment. They couldn't cut a guy's arm off or they couldn't hang him, but they could do just about anything else. Now the five prosecution witnesses then testified, the people whose testimony I've already talked about, testified to what they had seen and heard. Given a chance to defend themselves but not to have an attorney, because criminal defendants had no right to counsel in English law at this time, the defendants produced one witness in their behalf, Henry Cox. Cox testified in open court that he had lived in the Holt-Hudson household from August to mid-October, in other words, until about 3 weeks before the trial. He declared that, quote, "he doth not know of any difference or falling out betwixt them during that time." And he also said, quote, "he never saw the said Edward Hudson or Dorothy, the wife of Robert Holt, abed together, or any lewd or incontinent action or passage between them." Now, the judges either disregarded or simply disbelieved Cox's testimony, as do I. He strikes me as willfully deaf and blind to what was going on in the household, which was readily evident to such observers as John Medcalf and Rose Smith. So the judges convicted Dorothy Holt and Edward Hudson, and the penalties they assessed were severe. Hudson was ordered whipped with 30 lashes, and the court directed that he could not live closer than 20 miles to St. Mary's City, which is where the Holts were living. If he violated that order, he was to be whipped 30 lashes again. Dorothy Holt was to receive 50 lashes. Her sentence was harsher because adultery was a more serious crime than fornication, since it injured the innocent spouse. She was ordered to set up a separate household immediately, one at least 5 miles distant from Robert's, quote, "for the prevention of any mischief she may do to her husband." I guess they're trying to prevent her from poisoning his food or something. The court went on to threaten Edward Hudson and Dorothy Holt with further punishment if they continued their relationship. The judges, however, also encouraged the Holts to live together, as they said, as man and wife ought to do, if at any time both parties shall agree thereto. Presumably to that end, at Edward's and Dorothy's, as the court record says, humble submission and suit for pardon, acknowledging their great offense and promising future amendment, the court suspended the harsh sentences. Probably Edward and Dorothy offered their humble submission while kneeling in front of the judges, and that humiliation would have been their real punishment. In the end, the only formal penalty imposed on them was that Edward Hudson was ordered to pay all court costs, which were substantial because of the need to reimburse all the witnesses for their presence and to pay fees to the clerks who had recorded the statements and to the sheriff who had served the warrant. And I might add that the sheriff was given an extra fee because of the short notice involved in the case. So this was a substantial fine, but that's what it amounted to. Now, such an outcome was not uncommon in 17th century America. All the colonies, not just Maryland, had laws prescribing severe penalties that were in fact rarely imposed on miscreants. In Massachusetts, for example, convicted adulteries like Dorothy Holt were supposed to be executed, but only one couple in the early 1640s actually was hanged. All others accused of the crime in that colony were either acquitted, no matter how irrefutable the evidence of adultery, such as the birth of a child the husband could not have fathered, and that was one such case, or they were subjected to lesser penalties, such as shaming by symbolic hanging. Such sentences ordered the offenders to sit publicly on the gallows for an hour with nooses around their necks, but otherwise left them unscathed. Wouldn't that be an interesting punishment for sexual offenses today? Now, by combining harsh laws with lenity in practice, the colony simultaneously decried the crime while showing mercy to the criminal. In such tiny, close-knit communities, both aims were important. Legislators needed to define unacceptable conduct forthrightly and to ensure that colonists knew what they could and could not do in these distant outposts of Europe, composed of people drawn from many different communities and legal traditions. At the same time, actually imposing severe penalties on people well known to everyone was difficult. In fact, attempts to enforce the law fully and consistently could lead to open resistance. That's precisely what happened in Massachusetts when, in another adultery case in the 1640s, a group of prominent Bostonians clearly expected the colony's highest court to impose a death penalty on a couple. So they organized a preemptive jailbreak to prevent that from happening. Although the couple was soon recaptured and the resistors were heavily fined, their actions may have prevented the execution, because the couple was subsequently symbolically rather than actually hanged. There was simply just too much opposition in these colonies for the actual imposing of these draconian punishments that were written into the statutory law. Now, you all remember that Robert Holt, who in my reconstruction of the case was a more or less willing participant in the ménage à trois for some months, was not charged with any crime in 1651. His turn in court came almost exactly 7 years later, and information that emerged then tells us what happened in the interim. That's what's so wonderful about this case, because usually in the court records you just get one snapshot, but in this case I've got three snapshots. And so now we're moving on to snapshot number two of these very same people. On October 6th, 1658, a grand jury was impaneled to decide whether Robert Holt should be tried on a charge of bigamy. Quote, having married one Christian Bonifield, his own wife, Dorothy, being then and yet living. 4 months earlier, in early 1659, the grand jury, 4 months later, sorry, in early 1659, the grand jury decided to indict not only Holt, but also one William Wilkinson, a clergyman, who was accused as an accessory to the felony, quote, in contriving and counseling the marriage after he had divorced Robert Holt and Dorothy, his wife. Depositions taken from Holt, Wilkinson, Christian Bonifield, and two witnesses at the wedding disclose the sequence of events since November 1651, when Dorothy Holt and Edward Hudson had received their symbolic sentences. The defendants had not been dissuaded from their conduct. Indeed, they had continued to live together. And by December 1654, Dorothy had borne what were called two bastards, fathered by Edward. In that month, she and Robert approached Wilkinson, a Protestant cleric, asking him to draw up and witness a paper that both then signed. The paper, we know from this court record, quote, contained a release of all claim of marriage from Dorothy to Robert, and it also noted her refusal to be reconciled to Robert Holt. Now, in itself, the drafting and signing of such a document was not unprecedented in Maryland. Although Maryland had no law authorizing divorce, when marriages seemed irretrievably broken, the colony's justices themselves allowed these sorts of legal separations. In 1656, for example, the provincial court confirmed a division of assets worked out by a couple who were determined, as they put it, to live asunder. And in another case, the judges considered within just a few months of Robert Holt's, they accepted a couple's formal declaration that they disclaimed each other as marital partners and that they would not molest or trouble each other further. But two aspects of the Holt case distinguished it from those. First, the Holtz did not seek a legal separation from the court, as did the couples whose experiences I just described, but instead they merely consulted a clergyman. Their agreement to end their marriage was not then approved by the proper authorities. More important, however, was a second point. None of the other individuals involved in such cases sought to remarry. Holt, however, had actually done so. He explained to the court that he married Christian Bonnefield in January 1658 because the Reverend Wilkinson assured him, quote, that he was free to marry anybody by reason of mutual discharges from the bond of matrimony given between him and Dorothy, his former wife. For her part, Christian Bonnefield declared that she had never married to Robert Holt, but that Wilkinson said she and Holt might lawfully marry, and that diverse times coming to him to know his opinion in it, note this, telling him of her former husband and Robert Holt's former wife, he still told her she might marry to anybody. Now, unfortunately, aside from her appearances in connection with her marriage to Holt, there is little information about Christian Bonnefield in the Maryland records, nor is there any indication of who that mysterious former husband of hers might have been. Yet we do know a few things about her. She was a high-status woman, for the court clerk consistently termed her mistress. This is a title that's given only to high-status women. That probably means she was relatively well off, which is confirmed by further information that I'll discuss shortly. She was also about 13 years older than Robert Holt. Perhaps her anomalous marital status and her age combined to make her an unattractive marriage prospect, even to Maryland's desperate men. And only Robert Holt, who had problems of his own in that respect, was willing to take a chance on marrying her. Mistress Bonnefield's report of her diverse, anxious conversations with William Wilkinson indicates that she thought her former husband was still alive and that she had considerable doubt about whether she was free to remarry. That in December 1654, just when the Holts signed their divorce agreement, she got into a shouting and shoving match with a woman who loudly called her whore certainly implies that other Marylanders suspected her of sexual misconduct. Was she involved with Robert Holt even then, 4 years before their marriage, or was her behavior with some other man involved in this incident? It's impossible to know because Robert Holt's name does not appear. There's no other man. There's no man's name that appears in that record. We just know that about the time the Holts signed their agreement, she got involved in this shouting match with a woman who called her whore. Now, to understand the problem posed for Maryland's authorities by Holt's remarriage to Christian Bonnefield, we must recall that Maryland was founded and led by Roman Catholics, and that Catholics and Protestants defined marriage differently in the 17th century as they still do today. To 17th century Catholics, marriage was a sacrament, a bond that could be broken only by death once it was validly entered into. To Protestants, marriage was instead a civil contract between a man and a woman. If marriage was a civil contract, that implied, though it did not require, that divorce and eventual remarriage could be lawful, because a key characteristic of civil contracts was that they could be voided and rewritten. Accordingly, in the American colonies, it was in Massachusetts Bay and Connecticut that actual divorces, as opposed to just legal separations, could most readily be obtained, although still not very readily by modern standards. Divorces in those colonies occasionally carried with them the right for at least an innocent party to remarry, as, for example, when a spouse had committed adultery or bigamy, which is what had happened to Robert Holt. So in other words, if Robert Holt had been living in Connecticut or Massachusetts, he could probably have legally remarried Christian Bonnefield because he had been the injured spouse in an adultery case. But Maryland had no such policy. Maryland did not permit divorce and remarriage. Approving informal legal separations was as far as its courts would go. Moreover, the situation was complicated by the fact that the Colonial Assembly in 1649 had passed a law promising religious toleration to all settlers. That law created legal dilemmas like that presented by the January 1658 marriage of Robert Holt and Christian Bonnefield. How did it create such a dilemma? Well, in accordance with its tolerant policies, Maryland law provided that either clergymen or magistrates could perform valid marriages. And therein lay the conundrum. The Reverend William Wilkinson was legally authorized to marry people in the colony. He had declared Robert and Christian marriageable and indeed conducted a wedding ceremony for them. But Maryland had no law allowing divorce and remarriage. Accordingly, Robert Holt, at least, was unable to marry legally in the colony because his wife was known to be alive and living nearby. Now, we don't know Bonifield's husband's whereabouts, and probably neither did the Maryland authorities. That could have led to uncertainty about her marital status and explain why she was not also prosecuted. He could have died or something like that, so they might not have known. So that's why she, I think, is not charged in this case. It's why only Robert Holt and then the minister is charged. So Holt was, under Maryland law, a bigamist, and Wilkinson had abetted him in his commission of the crime. Two statutes, the Act for Religious Toleration and the marriage law, thus came into direct conflict with each other. The convening of the grand jury and the subsequent indictment of the two men revealed that Maryland officials had decided they could not ignore such an overt violation of the colony's laws. Still, since bigamy was a capital offense, the law, like the adultery statutes in Massachusetts, was very difficult to enforce. That became clear when Holt and Wilkinson were formally brought to trial on March 1, 1659. And this, what happened next, is absolutely unique in my experience in reading the Maryland court records. After a jury had been chosen to hear the case, Holt and Wilkinson objected to the jury, the entire jury. Occasionally, people are asked, do you object to a juror? And occasionally, people do object to a juror. In this case, Holt and Wilkinson objected to the entire jury, and this is what they said. Quote, "This jury is a very weak jury to go upon so weighty a business as life and death. And there being few others present in court but what are Catholics, which the prisoners afore requested might not be warned on their jury, desiring that a Protestant jury might pass on them, which the governor consented unto as most reasonable." So the case was adjourned, presumably to locate a sufficient number of Protestant jurors. But in fact, Holt was later graciously pardoned, and he continued to live with his new wife. Like his first wife, Dorothy, he had been threatened with severe punishment for sexual misconduct, but he'd also been treated leniently in the end. Now, why were the Catholic rulers of Maryland willing to accede to Holt and Wilkinson's request to be tried by Protestants? And why did they then grant the miscreants a pardon? The answer lies not only in the difficulty in imposing the death penalty for offenses other than murder, but also in the date, 1658-1659. Think of your English history. Puritans still controlled the government of England and would continue to do so until the restoration of Charles II the following year in 1660. Lord Baltimore, I've left out the story of Lord Baltimore losing his colony for a while. He'd only recently regained possession of Maryland from parliamentary commissioners who'd run the colony since 1655. He and his representative in Maryland, that is the governor, could not afford to anger the Protestant rulers of England by punishing an obscure Protestant colonist for divorcing his wife and remarrying, even if they did not approve of such behavior. Now note the key irony of this second prosecution. In 1658-1659, absolutely nothing happened to Dorothy Holt and Edward Hudson, even though she'd admittedly borne two bastard children by the lover she had been told to stay away from on pain of great lashings and so forth 7 years earlier. Why not? Because she, unlike her former husband, had not sought to legitimize her new union. And because Maryland courts, as I discovered when I was doing the research for founding mothers and fathers, usually did not punish the parents of bastards if the children had sufficient means of support. All that Maryland was concerned about is whether the children would become a public charge. If the children weren't a public charge, they didn't punish the parents. So since Edward and Dorothy were supporting their children, they were not prosecuted. Now, so that's snapshot number two. And fortunately, there is snapshot number three to tell us how it all came out. There's a third and final act. 3 years later, in March 1662, a grand jury again indicted Robert Holt for living with Christian Bonifield. He had continued to live with her, despite the fact that he'd been pardoned from before. But this time he died before he could be brought to trial. Now, before his death, Robert prepared a deed of gift, turning his entire estate over to his, quote, beloved wife Christian, while nevertheless directing her to give some of the land and livestock to his two surviving daughters. Probably as a consequence of the deed of gift, Christian became involved in a series of violent confrontations with her disinherited stepson, David Holt. Here's still another son. In June 1662, Christian, calling herself Holt alias Bonifield, you know, she doesn't know what last name to use, petitioned the Maryland authorities for assistance. Before what she termed her unfortunate marriage to Robert Holt, she said, she had had a considerable estate, and she had lived in a full and plentiful manner. But now she was being molested by her stepson David and threatened to be turned out of doors into the woods. She contended that the estate Robert had given her in this deed of gift was, quote, inconsiderable to the value of what she had when she was first married to him. Yet now it seemed she was going to lose even that to the stepson. Maryland's leaders, as it happened, sympathized with her plight. Of all the court decisions I've discussed today, their solution to Christian Bonifield's problem was perhaps the most intriguing. It took them several months to figure it out, I have to say. It took them until August 1662. They heard her petition in June. In August 1662, the court first ordered that, quote, whatsoever Christian Bonifield can make appear to be hers before the pretended marriage with Robert Holt, or that is purchased with that estate, shall be restored to her, the land accepted, end quote. In other words, the court treated her as a woman who had not contracted a valid marriage, even referring to her union with Holt as pretended. Had her marriage been valid, she could only have laid claim to a widow's share of his estate. In Maryland, that share consisted of absolute possession of a third of a man's personal property and a life interest in one-third of his landed property, which after her death would then pass to his heirs by blood, either children or collateral relatives. The court, in short, accepted Christian Bonifield's argument that she would suffer a considerable and unjust loss if the rule of the widow's thirds was strictly enforced in her case. She did lose the 100 acres of land her husband owned at his death. Remember, he had head rights to 300, so somehow, either he never took up some of those head rights, I don't know whether he did. I mean, in Maryland, he had to officially ask for the head rights, and so I don't know if he didn't take them up or whatever, whether he lost 200 acres in the interim. But in any event, he had only 100 acres when he died. She did lose the 100 acres of land he had owned, at least some of which, it appears, was brought with her property. But she was given her personal property, and also she was given whatever goods she could prove Holt had bought with her money. The inventory of Holt's estate reveals that the household had been better equipped than most homes at the time. Among other items, there were many ceramic dishes. There was something called a good fair looking glass. There was a pewter candlestick and salt cellar. There was a syllabub cup. That's a cup to make a fancy sweet, like a hot toddy, a sweet liquor drink. And most relevant here, six pewter dishes marked BC, her monograms. It's clearly hers. Most of these luxury household goods had probably been Bonifield's, and the court's decision ensured that she could retain them. Simultaneously, however, the court to settle what it called several controversies between Christian Bonifield and her stepson David, provided that while David Holt was to have all the land his father had owned, the rest of Robert's possessions were to be evenly divided between David and Christian, with the exception of tools, which he was to have, and a bed and a maidservant, which Christian was to have, along with her, quote, wearing clothes and ornaments, end quote, because a wife's property went into her husband's possession completely when she married. She basically had to be given back her clothes from his estate. In short, the court, in the second part of its decision, treated Christian Bonifield as a valid wife, with the same sort of claim on her dead husband's estate that any widow would have had. Well supplied with household goods and clothing and a maidservant, Christian then went on the following year to claim a 50-acre headright for herself, and she disappears from the documentary record. I like to think that she successfully established a small tobacco plantation and found another husband, because at least this time she knew her former spouse was safely dead. But of course, there's no way to know. So with that August 1662 hair-splitting decision concerning Robert Holt's estate, the family saga that began nearly 11 years earlier finally came to a close. But the narrative of the many trials and tribulations endured by Robert and Dorothy Holt, Edward Hudson, and Mistress Christian Bonifield has opened up for us the world of early Maryland in dramatic fashion, illustrating through the details of people's everyday lives two of the most important aspects of life in the colony. First, the heavily imbalanced sex ratio, and second, the policy of religious toleration. The preponderance of men in the population led Marylanders to experiment with a variety of family forms, some of which were more easily sustained than others. The Holts and Hudsons were not the only participants in a failed ménage à trois. Of course, we couldn't learn about the successful ones, for they didn't end up in court. I have no way of knowing how many successful ménage à trois relationships there were in 17th century Maryland. But once the sex ratio began evening out, by the late 17th century, those anomalous family forms disappeared. Only in very recent years in the United States have we once again created a society in which a significant proportion of people fail to live in households headed by married couples. And of course, that 21st century pattern, soon to be, as we all know, being historians, 21st century doesn't start until next January 1st. Anyway, the 20th century pattern has developed for very different reasons than a skewed sex ratio. The other experiment in early Maryland, that of religious toleration, proved considerably more successful in the long run. The Calvert family is to this day quite properly celebrated in the United States because the 1649 law began our nation's tradition of religious toleration that is today enshrined in the First Amendment to the Constitution. As we've seen, though, what seems to us a wise policy caused major difficulties for the colony of Maryland. Fortunately, Maryland's leaders rose to the occasion in the case of Christian Bonnefield. They preserved the veneer of legal authority while bending the rules to assist a widow whose stepson was trying to throw her out of her home, even though they simultaneously refused to accept her marriage as valid. Would that the courts today could consistently demonstrate as much wisdom. Thank you.